Okay, it's just about time for us to get started this morning. As we're all well aware, Bob's off on the road again. He's up in New York this week for the weekend. He'll be back a little later this week. But I'll have the class for today as well as on Wednesday evening. And as Bob went through and pointed out on last Wednesday evening, we're working our way through the third cycle, and he was gracious enough, and I was really appreciative, overly appreciative of the fact that he decided to go ahead and jump ahead and take the United Kingdom as it goes through and we start to have the parallel accounts. And he left me with going through and reviewing the period of the judges and really kind of going in and kind of exploring the judges, the stories associated with them. I know when you take a look at the booklet that we have, when you read about the third cycle and look at what it talks about, the period of the judges, it really boils down to just two bullet points. So it doesn't leave you a whole lot of material as far as discussion, as pointed out in the booklet, but it's not to say that there's not anything there. When you think about the period of the judges and the judges associated with it, there's quite a few stories. I know we went through the second cycle. We took the opportunity to go through and, again, bring back to memory those judges, the names of the judges, and some of the stories we have associated with each of those judges. Now, do we have a story to go along with each and every judge? No. But there were several, a handful of them, that there were some stories and things we can learn from those examples. But before we get too far into the judges, period of judges today, I want to go ahead and let's go back and Wednesday night we went through the 17 periods. Seemed like we struggled a little bit the first time. As we continue to build on this three-cycle approach, it's always important to always go back and remember those 17 periods. We can't take it for granted. As we continue to build upon each one, we have the foundation, which is the 17 periods, and then we start to put the stories inside each one of those periods. Now, hopefully we've been able to define those period times of periods and what stories are associated with them, but again, the building block is what? The 17 periods themselves. So, from the top, if you wouldn't mind, can we start off? Okay, very good. A little more unison than we'd had on Wednesday evening. But as I looked around, I didn't see all the mouths moving up and down. Now, you might have been thinking them in your head, but just like when we have our songs, I want to see everybody moving their mouth. I'd like to hear a little sound coming out. So let's try it one more time, just so we have it for a refresher. From the beginning, before the flood. Okay, very good. Much better. I appreciate that. As we mentioned, like I said, we're going to be talking about the period of the judges this morning. And it seems like a silly question, but where can we first learn of the period of the judges? What are we going to turn to in the Bible? Okay, the book of the judges. Okay, very easy one. Let's see here. Fire it back up again. Okay, so we've already gone through the 17 periods. Now, as we go through the judges, can everyone remember the names of the judges? Because I know we went over that quite a bit. And I know you were able to present that to Bob when you returned from his trip last time. Now, just like school, do we want to study for a test, just learn to do the test? Or do we want to learn the scriptures and the judges for the sake of we have them in our mind and we know that at any given point, someone comes up and says, what are the judges? We should be able to say the judges. So, who would like to start off with the first one? Othniel. Okay, very good. And I almost have to say that your presentation of the judges came off a lot nicer than the 17 periods. So, again, let's not forget to go back and keep the core 17 periods fresh in our mind and know what they are as we continue to grow and develop in each of the different periods and we continue to build upon our knowledge of scriptures. So we start off in Judges. Judges chapter 1. What do we learn about in the first book in chapter 1? What is it telling us about? Now, the best part about Third Cycle is we're looking less at the blue cover book and looking more at our own Bible. So let's go ahead and everybody turn to Judges chapter 1. As we've been doing thus far, we're going to go through and we're going to flip from page to page and take a look at what the scriptures have to say about that particular period. What can we find in those pages? So, Judges chapter 1. Okay, so we're learning about the conquests of the land. Now, they've already gone and taken the land. At the end of the invasion and conquest, we finish off that period with Joshua giving speeches. Now, what was he trying to encourage the people of Israel to do? Okay, to follow God, to be obedient to God, to remain strong in their faith. Now, what was other responsibility that they had, even after they conquered the land, and the land was theirs, and it was divided up, each one was supposed to go back to his tribe, or each tribe was supposed to go back to his apportioned land and do what there? They're supposed to get rid of all the idolaters. Even though the land had been conquered and it was theirs, there were still some remnants of the inhabitants, prior inhabitants. And so God's command was to do what? To get those out of there, to get rid of them, remove them completely so that they would not be a what? A stumbling block. Okay, exactly. And we've seen in the history of the Jews' relationship in faith and walk with God, sometimes they don't always stay the firmest on their path and walk with God. A lot of times it takes just a little bit just to steer them off their path, and we see where they've turned to idols before, and God recognized this, and he gave them the command to go through and remove those inhabitants, and in doing that, also removing that temptation for idolatrous worship. So in Judges chapter 1, we read with the book opening with a survey, the battles fought by the various tribes, but also tells of the failures for them to completely remove all the inhabitants of the land. So they did have some earnest, hard battles where they went and removed the inhabitants, but they didn't do it completely. And just like they say, a little leaven leavens a whole lump. They only need just a little bit of those remnants left behind to have a great effect on the nation of Israel. We're also introduced to Othniel at this point. Now, we know Othniel is being the first judge, but at this point, is he the judge over the land? Over the nation? No. At this point, he is just what? Okay. We're introduced to Othniel because Caleb has asked to go out and conquer an enemy. And what did he offer as a reward? He offered his daughter, offered up as marriage, for marriage. And so, not only was Othniel already kinsman to Caleb in that he was his nephew, but now we see that he comes even closer. Now he's actually his son-in-law. Othniel, again, is Caleb's nephew. And then we go into chapter 2. Now, chapter 2, I really, like I said, with this whole study, we don't really want to dive into any one area too much because we have our classes following this quarter that we're really going to start diving in and really studying and searching the scriptures per period. But really, I think in order to give justice to this study for the period of the Judges, chapter 2 is a great synopsis as far as telling you the relationship of the nation of Israel, their relationship to God, their faith, obedience, and lack of obedience. So what I'd like to do, if you don't mind, we're going to go through, we'll divide it up and read the entire book of chapter 2. Let's see, start off. Judd, if you wouldn't mind reading 1 through 5. Paul, if you could take 6 through 10. And then let's see, we'll go ahead and take 11 through 23. Who feels ambitious? All right, Steve, if you wouldn't mind. Okay, so Paul, if you could start off with, or Job, with chapter first one, please.
About when the angel
Thank you very much. Again, I mean, to look at this chapter and to see, we look back at the history of Israel and their faithfulness in serving God. I think in prior classes I've always kind of made the point of Israel's faith and obedience to God was sort of like a roller coaster. They're faithful, they're obedient, they're up here, but soon enough they turn away from God and they take that quick ride down. And it's not until they get to the very bottom that they realize that they're oppressed, they're without the love of God, the mercy of God, God's protection. And what they do is they turn around, they repent, and they turn back to God, and they start to climb back up again until they get to the top where they have the ability to fully participate in that covenant that God's promised to them, that protection, the love, the mercy, all the blessings that come just by simply obeying God, by following His commandments and keeping Him first. But as we see again, they like the roller coasters, up and down, up and down. And so chapter 2, I think, really does a great job as far as telling us about that relationship with God and how Israel tries to turn around, and it's as long as they have that judge there in front of them, they're faithful. But what happens when that judge dies? They're so quickly turned away. And so we see in verse 3 where Israel is rebuked by God for their actions, for not removing the inhabitants of the land. Verse 8, we now have the where Joshua dies. So now we no longer have that figurehead in front of them. We no longer have Joshua and his leadership skills to lead the nation. And so we see that shortly after Joshua dies, what happens? Okay. Not only do they go back into idolatry, but a generation arises that knows not God. Now, we talked about back in the Exodus how there was a Pharaoh who Joseph went and lent hand and through the providence of God provided and helped deliver the nation of Egypt as well as his own nation of Israel, and that Joseph was made second in command over all Egypt. But then eventually we see where a Pharaoh arose that knew not God and knew not Joseph and what Joseph had done through the hand of God. Now, kind of understandable, because this is a foreign nation. They're not favorable towards God. They just happen to be able to enjoy the benefit of Joseph being there and the blessings of God being bestowed upon him. And so we see that Egypt, because of Joseph's faithfulness, was receiving these blessings as well. But here we have God's chosen people, His covenant people, and now we have a generation that arises that knows not God. Now that shows that's a very sad state for God's chosen people. Verse 14, the Lord's anger burns against Israel to the point that we see in verse 16, they're given into captivity, and then the Lord raises up a judge. Now, when the judge died, again, Israel turned away. So again, that roller coaster is up and down. In verses 21 through 23, we read about other nations were left there to be a test to Israel to see if they could show their true faith and obedience to God. Do you think God was trying to be mischievous when He did this? Or if He was just trying to truly see, are you really truly My covenant people? Are you really truly committed to serving Me and Me alone? Now, that brings us to the end of chapter 2, which is a pretty good, again, a good overall synopsis of Israel's relationship with God. When we go into Judges chapter 3, what do we learn about? Exactly. I mean, they just fall right off the horse again, and there they are right there serving the idols again. Now, God left those other nations there, those other remnants there. He didn't allow them the power, give them the ability to go out and finish driving them out. They had to do it on their own. They also had to show by their faith that they could be faithful and obedient to God. Now, could Israel stand that test of faith? Well, when we look through the first part of Judges chapter 3, verse 5, it says that they lived among the other nations. Okay, there are remnants there. They just didn't have the heart to kick them out of their own land. They said, well, we'll let you stay here. Just you stay to your side, we'll stay to our side, and we'll live peacefully among each other. Is that what God wanted? Absolutely not. God could see further down the road than the Israelites with their short-sightedness. So He wanted them out of the land, but Israel allowed them to stay, and they lived among them. Now, did they go anything beyond just living among them? What happened in verse 6? They intermarried. So not only was Israel turning around and taking the daughters of these foreign nations as their daughter or as their wives, but they were also in turn giving their own daughters to the foreigners to give them as their wives. So, as we've talked about in previous classes, what happens when a man and a husband, they come together? The husband typically wants to do what? He wants to stay on the good side of his wife. He wants to keep the peace. And we see again where time and time again, even though the man or the individual that's a Christian, the one serving God, tries to be strong and faithful, who typically has the upper hand? It's usually the faithful, God's faithful, being led away into idolatrous worship. Verse 7, we see where God, they forsook God to serve Baals and Asheroth. And then verse 8, Israel falls into the hands of Mesopotamia. And then we see it was their idolatry, strictly their idolatry, that led them to their servitude. We talk about the roller coaster in the book, which we'll get into later on. We talk about the recurring cycle. Now, I call it the roller coaster ride. There's actually probably a better definition, which is the recurring cycle. What is the first period? Or what would we consider the? How does the cycle go? We start out with apostasy. So they turn away from God. They follow after other gods. And what happens? God allows them to do what? Fall under the oppression of their enemies. Now, at any time in the history of Israel, as long as they were faithful to God, did God ever deliver them over to their enemies? Okay. Not only did he not allow them to be handed over to their enemies, we can see where countless times and examples where there was just countless, numerous hosts that they were fighting against, but yet they gained the victory. Hopeless odds, and they still gained the victory. All because God was with them. God had his favor upon them because they were indeed their covenant people. He said, you obey me and obey me and follow me alone, and I will provide for you. But as soon as they turned around and walked away or turned away from God, they got a curious eye and they looked to the side after idolatrous worship. They started to fall away. God said, you've broken that covenant. I'm not going to continue to provide my love, my mercy, my protection for you. And he allows them to fall into the hands. So he had the oppression. Eventually they get to the bottom, the roller coaster ride, but more specifically, they start to repent. They realize their condition. They realize that without God, that they are nothing. So they repent. So God sends the deliverance. And then we have peace. So we see, we start out with turning away from God. The cycle begins with turning away from God, and you have apostasy. But you see, when we come to the end of the cycle, and they've only, all they had to do was turn around and give their simple faith and obedience back to God, what do they have? Peace. Okay? I think anybody in this lifetime, that's all they can ask for is peace in their life. To have peace. Not so much riches, not so much fame, but to have peace within your household, peace within your life. And that's what they have, which is by following God. But again, turning away, then you see what happens. They get oppression, and it's a constant cycle. So the pattern exemplifies God's justice, his mercy, and his love. As we talked about before, the covenant people, they're required. God says, I'm going to give you everything. I'm going to provide for you if you only give one thing back to me. And so if the people are not able to keep up with their end of the covenant, would it be fair of God to turn around and still provide them the protection, still provide them the love and mercy if they're not going to turn around and be obedient to him? No, because that would not make God a just God. So what was a judge? We talked about this before. It's not necessarily what we see in today's court system. It's not what you're going to see on the TV shows. Someone dressed up in a black robe banging a gavel. That's not what we have here. The judges were, comes from the word shofet, which is also from the word shafat. But Israel sinned and God oppressed them. God judged them. God's the one that placed the judgment upon them because of their own actions. But as soon as Israel repented, God forgave them. And once God forgave them, what happened? What was renewed? The covenant, exactly. The covenant was renewed, and so now they have the hope and the blessings given back unto them. It's been restored unto them. And so Israel, again, lived in peace. I have referenced page 61, not your page 61, but it's in the book, Bob Sanders' book, In the Days of the Judges. And like I said, we'll get to this in a later quarter, but on page 61, there's a really good paragraph I have. It says, notice these times of peace after the times of battle. Sometimes we think of the period of the judges as a time of solid warfare, but our country has never gone through such a long times of peace as the Israelites experienced during this period. This is where some of the overlapping of the judges may come. After a victory, the portion of the land that had been oppressed might have peace for years, while another part of the land was becoming sinful and was being afflicted by some other enemy. So again, we see We think of the judges and they're always being delivered and fighting and battling. But really, truly, there was a lot of time in there where it was peace. Because they were what? Faithful to God. Their faith and obedience to God provided them peace. And they had that. But again, as soon as they turned away from God, that peace went away. So although we think of the judges and them being delivered and battles, a lot of this time period also exists as a time of peace. And we also see that exemplified through the book of what? We read the book of Ruth, the story of Ruth. This is during a time of peace. We don't read of battles and everything going on. It's a time of peace. So the first judge we come to is Othniel. This is in Judges chapter 3, verses 7 through 11. So, as we already saw, Othniel was introduced to us in chapter 1. But I think as Bob likes to a lot of times we're introduced to a character, it's almost a cameo. We're given his name, some information about him, but it's not necessarily the whole story. In chapter 1, was Othniel the focus at that point? No. He was an introduced character. He has cameo here in chapter 1. But it's not until chapter 3 that we see that God raises him up to be a judge, to deliver the people. So Israel at this time began to serve Balaam and Asheroth. Now, who's Asheroth? Okay, another idol, but actually from this book, again, don't be afraid to grab this book, because if you don't already have it, it's good to go ahead and get it. You can study ahead, but a lot of information here. Okay, very good. This female. So, I mean, it's not so much that, I mean, it was bad enough that they already had enough idols. Now they created female counterparts of the idols. So, I mean, it's just, there was no end to their creation of idols. There was no end to their desire to follow somebody else besides God. And so we see where they're following Balaam and Asherah. And so now they're serving Cushan and Rishathaim. So now they're under the oppression. They're serving them for 8 years. God's delivered them. God's allowed them to go under the servitude to serve them for 8 years. And then they cry out to God. They realize what they've done is wrong. What they've done is put them in a condition that they're hopeless without him. And so what do? They repent and they cry out to God for assistance, for help. And so we see where Othniel is raised up to deliver Israel. There was peace for 40 years. So they turned away from God. They were under oppression for 8 years. But again, going back to the whole point of they lived in peace. They lived in peace for 40 years because they were faithful to God. Now, from the scriptures we read that we know that Othniel slew the king, but we don't have a whole lot of details as far as how it happened or what any more specifics than that. And we'll find that to be very true of a lot of the judges as we go through and study them, that we're not given the full synopsis, the full details of everything that happened and why it happened. We just know that God raised the deliverer, and in doing so, he was able to deliver his people, that they may be able to, again, join in that covenant relationship and live in peace. But with Othniel, we see again, he's raised up to deliver, and they lived in peace for 40 years, right?
Mm-hmm. They had that peace.
Yep.
It seemed like right after he passed away, it didn't take too long after that they started his family.
Exactly. I mean,
it was,
and you would think that the people of Israel could look back at their history and say, okay, here we tested God's faith, we tested our relationship with him, and what happened? But instead they don't. They just like a child keep going back to that stove and touching the stove to see what's going to happen again. Do they think there's going to be any type of different result? No, it's just their own selfish desire to follow their own selfish will instead of following the simple faith of God. And like I said, just like they had with Joshua, when Joshua passed on and the elders that served with him, once they were all gone, Israel immediately turned away back to idols.
Do you think that's because they failed to teach their children? Because now the generation, well, 40 years, mm-hmm. space, a lot of us, we think back, a lot of things changed in 40 years.
Mm-hmm. I had to wholeheartedly agree with you there. Like I said, we already talked about before how a generation rose that knew not God. I mean, we look at today's society and stuff and how many people out there really, people say, oh yes, I believe in God, but do they truly know God? Do they truly know what God's done for them? I mean, it's easy to say, I know God, but to know what he's done for you is a totally different scenario. And again, I think, sadly enough, I think our nation is on that path to where we're leaning towards a generation that knows not God. Unless something's done, we turn around and take control of our own households and expand it from beyond there to teach our children, and then hopefully beyond that to reach out to others and teach and help everybody understand the love of God and what's been done for them and the blessings that simply await by just their faith and obedience in God. But yeah, like I said, it's just as soon as that figurehead is gone, it's just like, oh, where'd he go? And they start looking around for him side by side. It's almost like he's gone and look for him side to side, and then, oh, what's this over here? And they just kind of immediately leave that path of faith and they move on. And so, yeah, and again, it goes back to the initial issue was they didn't remove the inhabitants of the land. If they simply obeyed God, they'd simply done what God commanded them, what we're going to continue to read of and study in the book of Judges, all this would have never happened. None of this would have ever occurred. They would have had nothing around them to distract their attention from serving God. And in doing so, they would have lived in peace. They would have lived in bountiful blessings. But instead, they allowed their people, allowed the inhabitants to stay. And we see time and time again, they fall away. So we go from Othniel over to Ehud. Now, I know we talked about this under cycle 2. We know a little bit about Ehud. Israel, as Ron pointed out, I said, as soon as Othniel died, Israel immediately, just again, they turned away. Here we have the recurring cycle. So they turn away, turn from God. And so now we see where God allows them to fall under the oppression, to serve under Eglon, the king of the Moabites. And there, this time, they served for 18 years. So this time he allowed them to stay under servitude for 18 years. They're being oppressed, being put down, because they've simply turned away their faith from God. And then we read how God, after Israel realized this, raised up a deliverer in Ehud to be the deliverer, to be the next judge. Now, what do we know about Eglon? Well, first we're going to get to first Eglon was the king, but what do we know about Eglon? How did the Bible and scriptures describe him to us? He's a very big fat man. And then when we talk about Ehud, we know that he was a left-handed. Okay. He turned around and he hit his sword on the right side. Now, as the time of the tradition of that day, most people they kept their sword, they're right-handed, so they kept their sword on the left side. Because if you're right-handed, you don't want to grab it like this, because then you come out all wobbly. But if you grab it out with your left hand, you can go right to business. But him being a left-handed man, he had an advantage. He could turn around and goes before the king. And, of course, they're going to look and search and make sure they have nothing there that's going to be any type of risk to the king. And they don't see anything on the left-hand side, but he has it hidden over here, and it's closed on the right-hand side. So Ehud goes before the king. Now, the first time he goes before the king, he goes to do what? To provide aid or give a tribute to the king. Okay, well, who doesn't like to receive a tribute? Who doesn't like to receive something from somebody else? I don't think anybody, most people aren't going to refuse. But then we see where he leaves, but then turns to go back. And this time when he goes back before King Eglon, what does he tell him? He says, I have a secret message. Now, even better than receiving a gift or a tribute, when you come to someone and say, hey, I got a secret. Well, all of a sudden, immediately there's a connection there. You're like, oh, we're so close to each other. So Eglon immediately tells everybody around him, leave. So him, Eglon, and Ehud, they go up to the upper room. So he's all excited. He said, he's got a message just for me. Me alone. I mean, who doesn't like a secret? So he immediately puts down his guard, takes Ehud with them. They go up to the upper room. And so, what was the secret message that Ehud had for Eglon? Okay, it was an 18-inch sword. He comes in and he says, I have a secret message. Message from who? Message from God. So he takes out immediately, just takes out a sword and sticks it right to his body. Now, we talked about how was Eglon described? Immediately, I mean, he was immensely fat. So he sticks that sword into him. Did he get to take his prized possession back out? No, he was so fat, he just stuck it into him, and it was gone. It just all the way up to the handle to where he couldn't even remove it. And so, again, You would think, well, immediately the guards would immediately just run over and take control and grab a hold of Ehud. But they didn't, because Eglon told him, hey, dismiss them all. I got a secret coming my way. I got a secret message just for me. And so he turned around, and Ehud, after he kills Ehud or Eglon with a sword, runs back, locks the door, and he escapes out through the front porch and leaves. Now, how long did the guards wait? I mean, obviously, Eglon's already told him, dismiss yourselves. I've got to spend some time alone just with Ehud. But after a while, you think, huh, he's been in there for a while. And what was their first response? They said, well, he must be relieving himself. They thought he was going to the restroom. But after a while, they became even more anxious and realized that maybe there's something wrong here. So they finally unlock the door. They get in there, and what do they find? They find their king face down on the ground because he's been killed. And so after Ehud departs, he runs, and immediately, does he just go and run and hide in the woods? What does Ehud do after he departs from killing Eglon? He goes out and he gets the people, and they do what? Okay? They go out and they start to take control, and they attack the Moabites, and they're given the victory. God gives them the victory. And so they will see, after they gain control of the land, or gain control over the Moabites again, they lived in peace for 80 years. So their time of oppression was a little longer, but at this point we have 80 years of living in peace. Now, during this time of peace, do we see everybody passing on the nation, of passing on to their younger generation the knowledge of God? We probably have a occurrence of that cycle again now. Getting comfortable, not feeling that they have to do anything because they've got God's protection, but in doing so, they neglect teaching God's word. And so we have the next judge which has risen up, which is Shamgar. No, they went back. If we go back, let's go back in verses 12, chapter 3, verse 12 through 30. Now, beginning of verse 26 says, now he had escaped while they were delaying, and he passed by the idols and escaped to Syria. And it came about when he arrived, he blew the trumpet in the hill country of Ephraim, and the sons of Israel went down with him from the hill country, and he was in front of them. And he said to them, pursue them. The Lord has given your enemies, the Moabites, into your hands. So they went down after him, seized the fords, the Jordan opposite Moab, and did not allow anyone to cross. They struck down, at the time, about 10,000 Moabites. So not only did they kill the king, they took this opportunity to turn around and kill 10,000 of the Moabites. And so there was a battle. God gave the enemy into their hands, all because they were faithful and obedient at this point. Now we go on, after we leave from Ehud into Shamgar, we thought we didn't know a whole lot about Othniel. What can we read about Shamgar? It's a long, lengthy reading. Okay. You can turn around, take the entire story of Shamgar, and cover it in one verse. Verse 31. Finish talking about Moab, and it says, after him, referring to Moab, after him came Shamgar, the son of Anath, who struck down 600 Philistines with an ox goad, and he also saved Israel. Now, I don't know that you're going to be able to turn around and take an entire class and dedicate an entire class teaching the children about Shamgar, but again, there's still information there that we know that is going to be interesting to the children. What's going to be interesting to the children to help them remember who was Shamgar? What did he do? He killed 600 Philistines. Not with a mighty army? No. Not with an axe? Not with a sword? Not with a exactly. He killed 600 Philistines with an ox goad. Now, that's something that children are going to remember. That's something that's going to be of interest to them. You turn around and tell them, this one man went out and killed 600 Philistines with an ox goad. He didn't turn around and send over a mighty army. He didn't turn around and send some great weapon of war. It was an ox goat. And he was able to kill 600 Philistines, and in doing so, help save Israel. The entire story found in one single verse. So again, that'd be an easy one for to teach children to, hey, this is where you can find the entire story of Shamgar. All we only way to know is the son of Anath, and he killed 600 Philistines with an ox goat. Now, we come to the story of Deborah. We're going to have a little more information, a little more details, and a little more to learn from the story of Deborah. During the time of Deborah, we see where Israel again turned away, fallen idols. They're given into the oppression or hands of Jabin, the king of the Canaanites, and they were serving under Jabin for 20 years. And during this time, we have Deborah. And how do we learn about Deborah? What was she doing? How was she judging the people? Under the palm tree, exactly. But we also learn that in addition to Jabin, the king of the Canaanites, we also have another main character that really kind of plays an important part of this whole story, and that's Sisera, who was the head overall of Jabin's army. The one thing that the Canaanites did have going for them, if you would want to call it a weapon of war, is they had 900 iron chariots. Okay? Now, we think of 900 iron chariots today, and we say, oh, that's nothing. We've got tanks, we've got this, we've got that. But back then, 900 iron chariots was pretty much us, the equivalent of us saying, hey, we have an atomic bomb. You don't, so you're going to fall under fear to us. At this point, they had 900 iron chariots, and there's nothing that they could do to turn around and battle against these chariots because they had no weapon to protect themselves against. Well, they did have a weapon, they just chose not to use it, which was their faith and obedience in God. If they'd only believed in God and had faith and obedience in God, those chariots would have been nothing to the Canaanites. But because they had turned around and turned their faith away from God, with these chariots, they just greatly, greatly, greatly intimidated the people of Israel. The nation of Israel, they were just intimidated by these. They had nothing they could do against it. So Deborah calls Barak to lead the army. And she says, God told us that he will deliver your enemy. He's going to deliver an enemy into our hands. She says, I need you to go out, gather an army, and lead that army. And God's going to deliver the victory unto us. And what was Barak's response? He says, I'll go as long as you go. Now, what was Deborah's response to that? Okay, exactly. She said that first she pointed out that, hey, I mean, God's given us the victory. God's going to give you the victory. So we see that Barak obviously didn't have the same amount of faith that Deborah did. And so Deborah tells him, well, I'll go with you, but if I go, the victory's not going to be won by your hand. It's going to be won by the hand of somebody else. A woman. Okay. Now, I think we talked about this during the second, we were doing the study of the second cycle. Here you are, you're the leader of the army. And do you want to find out that your victory is going to come at the hand of a woman? As a guy, that's going to be a real blow to your ego. But nonetheless, Deborah goes along with them, and we see the rest of the story where God turned around because of God's hand, God's ability to help deliver his people. Those 900 chariots that they feared so much, God rendered them useless. They couldn't move around in the mud. They couldn't go up the slopes. They were pretty much useless. There's absolutely nothing that they could do with those chariots except for do what? Abandon their chariots, okay? So they abandoned their chariots. What does that make them? Pretty much on equal playing field, level field, as the nation of Israel. But again, they're not so much equal because, again, they have God with them on their side, and they start to pursue the Canaanites. They pursue them, they kill them. And we see where Sisera, the leader of the army, he's not like a boat captain. He's not going down with a ship. He's decided he's abandoning his chariot, and he's running for it. And he runs, and he runs, and he runs. And he flees all the way to the tent of who? He fled to the tent of Heber, the Kenite. Okay? So we see where he goes, and he thinks he's made enough distance. He's put himself far enough away from Israel. from Barak that he's going to be able to, he can stop. He's running for his life, so he's tired. He comes to the tent, and who comes out to meet him? Jael. The wife comes out to meet him, and he asks for something to drink, so she gives him some milk. She lays him down, makes you think back to like kindergarten, drink your milk and then take a nap. Well, that's a Jael, kind of same process here. He was tired, and so he lays down, and he's fast asleep. And what did Jael do? Because Sisera gave her specific instructions. If you see anybody coming, you tell them, I'm not here. Send them the other way. But what did Jael have in her mind to do? To kill him, okay? Did she put some poison in the milk? No, that would have been too subtle. What did she do? She turned around, took that tent spike, right through the temple. Okay, Sisera going to get up from that one? Absolutely not. So at this point, we can say that the victory has been won by the hand of Barak or by the hand of Jael. So just as God had predicted, Deborah told Barak, the victory will be won, but it's not going to come by your hand. And that's what we see. It's fulfilled. Now, why does Sisera feel like he was safe at the tent of Heber, the Kenite? Okay, there was peace between those, but was Heber, did he join himself with the rest of the Kenites, or did he separate himself? Remember, Heber actually separated himself from the rest of the Kenites. And so, even though he thought he was in a safe location, a safe house, so to speak, he was anything but in a safe location. And so we see where Jael kills Sisera. Now, we come to Gideon. And with Gideon, we have even more to tell than Deborah. I think this is Gideon, like I said, until we get into Samson and Samuel, Gideon's going to be one of the judges where we have a lot of information, a lot of knowledge and understanding we can pick and learn from. And so with that being said, I'm going to leave it for Wednesday night. Thank you.